Hello, my name is Tom Steininger, and I welcome you to Radio Enlighten Next. This is the first international edition of our webcast that we usually do in German language, and this is the first one in English language. And I welcome Steve McIntosh, who is on the line with us. Steve, are you on the line?
I am. Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Steve, it's fantastic to have this conversation with you, and the reason why we have this conversation is also because you are coming over to Europe. You will be presenting at the first international forum on the evolution of consciousness on October 13th in Paris at the Sorbonne, and we are very much looking forward to see you there, and we thought it would be great to have a conversation with you and also what you want to bring to the conference in Paris ahead of time so that people also see what they will get when they come to Paris. And I'm in the lucky position to have an advanced reading copy of your new book, Evolution's Purpose. And I had a chance to look through it, and I'm really impressed about your research about evolution. And I have a direct question which comes directly from the title you chose, because the title Evolution's Purpose is a very particular title because it brings two things together that usually don't show up in the same sentence. Evolution, the whole concept of evolution, which is a scientific concept, and the concept of purpose. How can evolution have a purpose? Is there something that you can say from a scientific point of view that evolution can have a purpose? And if yes, what do you mean with evolution having a purpose?
Yes, the title is intentionally provocative, and I have a subtitle that includes a scientific an integral interpretation of the scientific story of our origins, just to sort of signal that it's not a creationist text, or I'm not advancing unscientific theories like intelligent design, but purpose is in evolution, right? All life forms have the purpose to survive and reproduce. And humans have a sort of a second-order purpose to try to evolve their culture and make the world a better place, just sort of continuously improve their conditions. And so purpose is not just an epiphenomenal element. It's central to the entire evolutionary process, especially in life and human culture and consciousness. And in the book, I argue carefully for purpose in evolution, not an externally controlled or sort of imposed from outside kind of purpose, but a purpose that arises from within the evolutionary organisms themselves, and which is a driving factor in the unfolding of evolution.
I mean, usually when we talk about evolution, we talk about evolution in either a biological context, or we talk about evolution maybe in the context of evolution of society. But is there really something where you can see that there's a purpose as being something inherent in an evolutionary concept? How can we say that purpose is something that is really part of this unfolding that we call evolution?
Sure, I'm glad that we're focusing on this, because one of the reasons that I wrote this book was specifically to address people who are skeptical of spiritual interpretations of evolution and who feel that, for example, one of the great breakthroughs of Darwin's discovery of biological evolution through natural selection is the amazing way that it works without any purpose or design, right? Whether it's just sort of the random mutations of genes and genetic drift are then coupled with the sorting process of environmental selection to produce the unfolding, and it's all sort of automatic and inexorable, and that is a kind of a beautiful feature of biological evolution. Is it the way it just sort of occurs naturally that way? But first, in the book, I explain what I mean by evolution. Right, evolution is not just the descent with modification of species of organisms. Evolution is really everything in the universe is subject to one kind of evolution or another, right? It's only been a few decades since scientists have discovered the rather unsettling fact that the universe itself is only 13.7 billion years old, and that matter has gone through its own process of cosmological evolution before the emergence of life. So evolution really includes the evolution of matter, which we see in the structures of atoms and molecules, the evolution of life, which you see in the structure of cells and organisms, and the evolution of human consciousness and culture, or what we might call psychosocial evolution, which is the reason that the development of human history is real evolution, is that it is resting upon and using the accomplishments of the previous levels. So, for example, just as life uses matter as its platform, right? Bodies are made out of matter, but they can't be entirely reduced thereto. The human consciousness and culture is a domain of evolution that rests upon a biological foundation, right? You know, there's no evolution in consciousness and culture if we don't have bodies and brains. But just like life transcends matter while using it, human consciousness and culture transcends biology because it results in a new category of evolution that emerges in different ways and uses different methods of development. But nevertheless, we can tie all forms of development in the universe together through this chain of emergence, this chain of transcendence and inclusion, this chain of instrumental use that brings us from the hydrogen debris of the Big Bang all the way to our global civilization.
Would you agree that evolution first was a modernist concept? Evolution was a concept that basically started with our modern scientific worldview, and I would say the first evolution theories came from philosophy, very much also German philosophy, talking about Hegel or even Leibniz. But then, of course, with biology, it became, with Darwin, a scientific concept. And then it also became a concept with Comte as the evolution of society. Evolution in itself is very much something that developed with a modernist worldview and got really criticized by the postmodernists. Why do you think that talking about evolution now, in kind of the height of postmodern times, is something that is really something new and something beyond a modernist understanding of evolution?
Sure. That's an excellent question. First, it's important to mention the history of the idea a little bit, as you started to, referring to, you know, the idealists and to Kant. The first recognition of evolution was really in human history and society, but then when biological evolution was confirmed in the middle of the 19th century, theorists generally connected biological evolution with social evolution and tried to understand them, you know, through the same terms. But because of the immaturity, the moral immaturity of modernist society in the 19th century, notions of cultural evolution were used to justify colonialism and oppression. And these sort of ethnocentric notions of cultural superiority gave the idea of cultural evolution a bad name, and for good reason, right? And so in the 20th century, there was a move toward multiculturalism where we tried to reduce the hubris which had resulted in colonialism and oppression of the developing world by the developed world. But ironically, the recognition that we couldn't just sort of have a linear conception of cultural evolution whereby the more developed world could claim that it was simply more evolved than the less developed world, those egalitarian notions were evidence of cultural evolution itself, right? Cultural evolution proceeds dialectically, whereby the opportunities for improvement are in a sense defined by the pathologies of a given society. But because so much of the definition of improvement is defined by what's currently wrong, then the move away from that inevitably is sort of has a sort of latent pathologies of its own, which require an additional course correction in the future as those pathologies come to pass. So, for example, we see traditional religious civilizations emerging beyond a culture of chaos and warlords. But the very same advances that traditional society brings in terms of order and relative peace is a form of rigidity and oppression, which then defines, you know, the opportunity to improve conditions in another way through the emergence of freedom, through modernism, through democracy, through meritocracy. But that that same advance of making the world a better place by making it more able for people to break out of their caste system and achieve things, that then creates its own pathologies of inequality, which then signal, you know, the opportunity for improvement in another direction. So history, in its course, although it's not linear, it definitely exhibits a structure. And that structure involves both the emergence of progress and pathology, right? Progress and pathology are kind of an indestructible polarity that are linked, and which require evolution, cultural evolution, to continue to move forward to overcome the pathologies that inevitably come with the steps of progress that it makes.
I mean, postmodern theory really questions this kind of concept, because basically postmodern theory really thinks that the idea of progress, also the idea that we humans can put purpose on the evolution of nature and the evolution of the biosphere, is a very anthropocentric point of view. And they criticize that as an outcome or as a development of this point of view, many of the crises of the 20th century directly come from this wrong understanding or this understanding, as they say, of evolution and this anthropocentric point of view. Isn't there some truth to that, that basically really trying to understand the world, the cosmos, as something that is developing and where we are at the peak of this evolution is a kind of a questionable concept?
Sure. I'm thoroughly aware of all the arguments against cultural evolution. The arguments are sort of values are relative, and cultures are independent lines of development. And there's really no objective morals. There's only customs, right? And one group does not have the legitimate right to sort of enforce its morals or its customs on another group because these developmental lines are independent. So, in the book Evolution's Purpose, I carefully argue as to why value relativism is a legitimate conception, but you can't take it too far. And so I'll come back to that in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I also deal with the charge of anthropocentrism, like any that humans just think they're special because of their arrogance, or this notion of humans being sort of different than other animals has led to the destruction of the environment and the sort of the hubris that just comes from conceit. And so these are important charges, and they've both been leveled against immature notions of progress, both in culture and in biology. And, in the book, I develop careful arguments to counter these and to show how, no matter what you say, evolution is a prolific generator of value. In other words, things become more valuable as evolution proceeds in time. It's not just a matter of complexity. There's actually real value occurring. But the mistakes that have been made, both in anthropocentrism and in absolutistic notions of value, have failed to realize that not only are things getting better, but the things which have been transcended are also getting better. In other words, value is emerging in two directions, in both an instrumental and intrinsic. And so, it's hard to explain this in the course of a recorded dialogue, and I can point readers to my book. But I can say that the structure of emergence itself is, in a sense, shows that humans are not just plain members of the biotic community, although our bodies may not be that different from the bodies of other complex mammals, primates or any intelligent mammal has advantages in certain ways over humans. But the reason that humans can say they're, quote, special is that humans have achieved a new level of evolution that transcends biology, right? Anything you can say about humans, you can say about animals to a degree, right? Animals value, they love their offspring, they can exhibit some kind of primitive forms of cultural evolution, they have primitive forms of language. But human culture, obviously, as evidenced by our global civilization, develops and evolves in ways that no animal culture or, quote, civilization has ever evolved. And because we, in a sense, represent this new and transcendent category of evolution, even though we're using biology, even though we, if we destroy the planet, if we destroy nature, if we pollute, life, we're obviously pulling out the rug from underneath us. We have to be wise enough to recognize that even though human civilization is an emergent category of evolution that transcends both life and matter, that very emergence has made life and matter more fundamentally valuable, right? So if human civilization disappears, that's probably good for life. But when we recognize that life is made more valuable by the emergence of human consciousness and culture, because evolution itself is becoming more valuable as a result of this new domain, this new category that's emerged, then we can begin to appreciate how we can think about progress in ways that are neither overly anthropocentric nor ethnocentrically hubristic.
That's cool. If I may hone on this one thing that you said, because I think that's really that's the most interesting part to really understand what you're saying, because you're saying the emergence of humanity made life more valuable.
Yes.
And that's quite a statement to say, because you're saying it's not okay, we are a new species, and it's great there's a new species, they're all kind of species, but you say the emergence of humans made life more valuable. I really would like to hear why are you saying this? Why is this planet, Earth, more valuable, or what's happening here more valuable, because there's a species coming that's like us humans? What do you mean by that?
Right. So let me try to explain that. one of the greatest American thinkers of the 20th century is a professor, Holmes Ralston III. He was awarded the Templeton Prize, which is a big intellectual prize here in the United States in 2003. And Ralston was famous for developing a theory of value in his book, Environmental Ethics. And this theory of value was then adopted by Ken Wilber in his 1995 book, Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. Wilber called it holonic ecology, but it really comes from Ralston. And what Ralston saw is he was dealing with the problem of how can we value nature in a way that's sort of post-Christian or in a way that deals with this problem of anthropocentrism. Because up until then, when there were arguments made for preserving nature, or creating a national park, or passing an Endangered Species Act, the question was, is nature only valuable to humans, or is nature valuable unto itself? And if nature is valuable unto itself, what does that mean about value? In other words, in existential philosophies and materialistic philosophies of all kinds, logical positivism, values are seen as projections of the human will. They're subjective, right? What's beautiful or what's true or what's good is simply whatever we think it is, and we sort of project value on the world, right? The world itself, there's no objective value. That was discarded as some pre-modern Platonic idea of perfect forms. Smart philosophy supposedly transcended that. But the trouble is if you make all value subjective, right, then that means that the only value that nature has is the nature that humans give it. And to Ralston, that didn't seem right. His intuition was that nature really does generate value and have natural value before humans come along. And so in order to kind of come to a philosophical and analytical sort of explanation and argument for why that is the case, and not just an intuitive notion of nature having value, Ralston was able to see that as the parts and wholes, the holons, if people are familiar with integral philosophy, they know that the structure of evolution at every level, matter, life, and human culture, involves whole parts, right? A cell is a part of an organism, but it also contains other parts, right? It contains molecules, and molecules are wholes, but they also contain atoms, and all the way down and all the way up. And so these whole parts, as they emerge, we can see levels of transcendence and inclusion, right? So molecules transcend and include atoms. Cells transcend and include molecules. And as these levels of emergence, which are not only structural, but they occur sequentially in time, right? First there were only atoms, then there were molecules, and then there were cells. And in this structure, as one stage emerges, the more levels of emergence that it uses and incorporates within itself, the more intrinsic value it has. But as stages of development, these structures become more intrinsically valuable, more whole, because they contain more parts, the parts in turn also become more valuable, more fundamentally valuable, more instrumentally valuable. So, for example, atoms are they have value in the universe by themselves because they're the elements, they're the building blocks. But they're also valuable to everything that comes after, right? If you wipe out all atoms, then nothing is nothing above atoms is left. So atoms are the most fundamentally valuable thing in the universe, in a sense, because they're the, sort of the building blocks of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we scale up to nature. We can see that, for example, you know, bacteria in the ocean that are, you know, the sort of the foundation of the food chain, that if those were to become wiped out, then the entire food chain would collapse. So those, in a sense, are in some ways the most valuable because they're the most fundamental. But, for example, a humpback whale is got not only, you know, there are these levels of emergence from bacteria to all the way up that contribute to this you know, highly valuable mammal's life. And the fact that this mammal embodies within it all these other stages of evolution, every new stage, you know, from bacteria to vertebrates to you know, reptiles to mammals, we can see this transcendence and inclusion in their own brains, right? The brain of a whale shows these stages. It's got a central nervous system. It's got a reptilian brain. It's got a limbic system. It's got a cortex. These in the structure of the brain, these stages are actually transcending, including literally. So Ralston's theory of value in nature, his basis of environmental ethics, whereby as stages emerge and use other stages, they become more intrinsically valuable, has been extremely influential in American philosophy and has been imported into integral philosophy through Wilbur, and now I take it further in my book.
Interesting. Now, I understand. I still would like to hear more why you call it more valuable. I do understand that it adds complexity.
Mm-hmm.
I do understand the holonic nature that you're describing,
mm-hmm.
that includes the parts and the whole half and holonic structure in itself, and it becomes a higher complex system. But to call it more valuable is some additional quality that you're bringing in.
Sure.
And I would like you to speak a little bit why you use this word. You could say it becomes more complex, but yet that's not what you mean.
Right. Well, that's part of it. I mean, you know, but the complexity itself doesn't add the value.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. One of the foundations for my argument comes from Alfred North Whitehead,
mm-hmm.
who actually defined evolution as an increase in the capacity to experience what is intrinsically valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So let me say that one more time. Whitehead's definition of evolution is consciousness-centric. He sees evolution as really sort of about the development of consciousness, and therefore evolution is defined as an increase in the ability to experience what is intrinsically valuable. So does matter experience anything? I mean, it depends on how much, you know, Whitehead you buy. But here,
okay.
There's matter in the universe, right? Before the emergence of life, you know, the universe is arguably insentient. And then the momentous emergence of life occurs. It's a whole new category of evolution. You know, life isn't just matter. Life is, as Lynn Margulis said, life is matter that chooses. And this ability to choose, even though it's, you know, kind of very automatic and genetically pre-programmed in the earliest forms of life, it quickens as life becomes more complex. Not only is life becoming more complex, but with the complexity of the organism, the consciousness of the organism is increasing as well. You know, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was very famous for his law of complexity and consciousness, and he argued that the complexity of an organism is directly proportional to the consciousness of that organism, with, of course, the human brain being the most complex thing in the known universe. But coming back to this idea of consciousness being sort of an important factor in the evaluation of evolution, if we pull back a little bit and look at this, at the three main domains of evolution, there's the cosmological evolution of matter, the biological evolution of life, and as I argue, and as is a tenet of integral philosophy, that this domain of the noosphere, as Teilhard called it, the emergence of consciousness and culture, the evolution of human history, that in itself is a form of evolution that's different from life and matter, but because it uses life and matter and continues the process of this emergence, it's still authentic evolution. It's not just like evolution. It's a grounded part of the evolutionary process. And as we look at this structure of matter, life, and mind, the three great domains, we can begin to recognize that life, the emergence of life, adds value to matter because it brings value into the world. And this goes back to what I was saying earlier about what is value. Value is not just subjective. It's both. It's neither completely subjective nor completely objective. Values aren't just things in the world waiting to be spotted, but they're not just projections of the human mind either. As I, again, carefully argue in my book, values are more like electricity. They bring subject and object together. They have a pole, a subjective pole and an objective pole. Mm-hmm. And so they require consciousness to bring them into the world, to see value, but they also require the ontological quality of the universe, right? There has to be quality, real quality in the universe for value to exist, because otherwise it's just a subjective projection. So to not fit this idea of value into either wholly subjective or wholly objective categories liberates us to recognize value and recognize evolution as a prolific generator of value. So if value requires consciousness to bring it into the world, to bring this electrical pole of quality and the appreciation of quality into the world, life begins to do that. Life brings consciousness into the world. Life brings value into the world because for the first time, life is exhibiting a quest for value. You know, that is, life doesn't work unless there's intentionality, unless there's a striving to survive and reproduce, unless life forms value surviving and reproducing, then the evolution of life is impossible. So by having value, by bringing value into the universe, life, in a sense, creates value. Life makes matter count. And by bringing value into the world, it becomes more valuable. Likewise, when humanity emerges and is able to recognize value at a much higher level, right? Like animals may be able to recognize beauty and goodness in their own way, but humans clearly have the ability to recognize the beautiful, the true, and the good in increasing measure. And because of the subjective pole of value, as humans emerge in the world, they bring value into the world because they can see it and they can create it. And indeed, they've been trying to create it for the 200,000 years that we've been around, as evidenced by the improving conditions that humans have achieved through their cultural evolution.
Yeah. I mean, if I understand you right, and I wrote down that you used a couple of minutes ago, you used the word choose. When life starts, somebody is choosing. And that this is basically, when you're choosing, you're choosing a value. You're choosing something against something different. And what starts to happen there one could say, the beginning of subjectivity. Because choosing means someone or something chooses something in a context. And you said then, as soon as something like human life, human consciousness starts to happen, we start to recognize our choices, our values. So there are two steps that you're describing here. First, that with life, with the beginning of choice, there's something happening that in itself brings value into reality, because it makes value judgments. It chooses something against something different.
Right.
And human consciousness, with the recognition of choice, we understand that we do have values, or we discuss having values, and we don't know any other species discussing values. You're talking about an evolution of interiority that is new, that in itself is really describing an evolution that really also includes everything postmodern values are talking about. Is it true?
Indeed. And, I mean, when we look at life, and we say, well, what is it that distinguishes life from matter, right? This is biologists have argued, you know, in trying to really pin down what it is from a materialistic standpoint. And again, Lynn Margulis, who recently passed away, but who's a very prominent biologist in the scientific community, she was famous for making fun of these biologists, because at one conference, all these different biologists suggested their criteria for how to judge whether something was alive or not alive. And she made fun of them by saying, well, your criteria could mean that, you know, a thermostat is alive, right, because it responds to its environment and it moves up and down. She said that what really distinguishes matter is this choice, is this ability to choose. And this point has been really well developed by Stuart Kaufman, who's a complexity theorist and another prominent biologist and scientist. And he calls, you know, bacteria and the earliest forms of life minimal molecular agents, right? Uh-huh. Even though, you know, we can analyze how their decisions are made in a sort of stimulus-response way, like a thermostat, there's still something that's spontaneous and non-predictable. You know, no possible computer could predict the behavior of a bacteria because it has that spontaneous autonomy. And so what it's this emergent purpose, or maybe we could call it quasi-purpose, you know, that within life is the key thing that we can say that matter does not have. In other words, the momentous emergence of intentionality within life forms is what kind of creates not only a new category of evolution, but arguably, in a sense, a new law of physics, right? Like, where does this come from, this purpose, this intentionality, this striving? You know, you can't explain it through physics or chemistry. You know, it's an emergent property which is irreducible. And so the quasi-purpose, if you will, of life forms, you know, even though they don't have complete freedom, is then just as it's nevertheless a momentous emergence that distinguishes the whole category of evolution, we can analyze a very similar thing occurring with the momentous emergence of human self-consciousness. Because a higher order of purpose, a freer degree of purpose occurs with humans. So if animals have quasi-purpose, humans have like second-order purpose or you know, complete purpose. And even though, you know, we're constrained and you know, even though the insights of, for example, evolutionary psychology or sociobiology show how so many of our choices are predetermined by, you know, the adaptations of our ancient ancestors, or, you know, there are all kinds of influences that we're unaware of both culturally and subconsciously. Nevertheless, humans possess relative degrees of freedom. And the more consciousness evolves, the more freer our will is, the less determined we are. So because we can not only have purposes to survive and reproduce, but we can have higher forms of purpose. We can have world-changing purposes. We can have purposes for beauty and truth and goodness that make the world a better place for everyone. We can have purposes that take more than a lifetime to fulfill. And it's this freedom of purpose, in a sense, that liberates the evolution of consciousness and culture into a new domain. So just as the purpose of life forms distinguishes it from matter, the free will purpose of human beings, the self-conscious awareness of the ever-widening potential of a better way, this is what constitutes the evolutionary realm of human culture as a new significant domain of evolution where there are, in a sense, arguably new laws of the universe, which we can point to human freedom as the evidence thereof.
I'm very happy that you brought in the beauty, the truth, and the goodness, because ever since I've heard of, about your work and you talking about the evolution of the beauty, truth, and goodness, I'm very fascinated how you can combine these two values, beauty, truth, and goodness, with evolution, as you do in your work. And as you said before, the recognition of value is an intrinsic human capacity. And to be able, as humans, to develop this understanding of beauty, truth, and goodness is an understanding of evolution that is not just an understanding of our capacity to survive. It is an understanding of our values. Could you speak to that?
Sure. And thanks for bringing that up. That is kind of central to the work. And indeed, in evolution's purpose, in trying to incorporate all criticisms and all sophisticated philosophies that have argued to the contrary, I argue that evolution is moving toward the experience and creation of the beautiful, the true, and the good. This is where evolution is headed. And the reason that we know that is that evolution is occurring within us, right? To be human is to know what it feels like to be evolution happening. And so when we feel the call to live up to our potential, to help others, to make the world a better place, to improve our conditions, the beautiful, the true, and the good define what improvement or better actually means. Now, as I said earlier, there's a subjective and objective pole of value. It's neither totally objective nor totally subjective. So the listener may say, well, what's beauty? I mean, beauty is completely subjective, and truth too. I mean, every stage of cultural evolution has a different conception of truth. And indeed, some of the world's greatest problems right now occur because we have some people who view science as the authority on truth, and other people who view religion as the authority on truth, and there are significant degrees of conflict between these conceptions of what's true. But when we understand cultural evolution and the structure thereof. We see that the structures that stand out are reality frames or stages of worldview development. And so we can see, you know, it's not linear, and I don't want to reify these stages. Again, there's valid criticisms of simplistic accounts of this, and in the book I try to provide a nuanced account of this structure of development. But for purposes of our conversation here, I can say that each historically significant stage of cultural evolution in humanity's history has been a kind of a worldview that includes a description of what's valuable. So, for example, the traditional religious worldview has its own version of what's true and its own version of what's good and its own version of what's beautiful, its own version of how the world can be made a better place and what's wrong with the world, defined by those values. The values create the membrane of the reality frame, if you will, right? The values proscribe the worldview. And the worldview is sort of made up. It has a metabolism of values. It's because it's trying to make the world a better place, that's what a worldview does. It stabilizes society. It causes agreement among people within a given culture so that they can work together. It defines the scope of those worthy of moral consideration. You know, it points to the authority of a particular teaching or understanding as what's true. You know, and it has an aesthetic quality, which also is an important form of these worldview agreements. So the beautiful, the true, and the good, in a sense, form octaves. You know, just like we see octaves in sound, right, moving up the scale, we can see octaves of value within the course of cultural evolution. So, you know, not only have humans strived to improve their conditions, you know, for our entire history, but humans have most dramatically improved their conditions by improving their definition of improvement itself, by the emergence of a new worldview, a new reality frame with a new set, a new octave of the beautiful, the true, and the good. For example, we see in modernism, you know, when modernism emerges in the Enlightenment and takes hold in the developed world through the Industrial Revolution, we see higher qualities of goodness in the sense that instead of a feudal system, we have a democratic system where there's careers open to talent and there's human rights and there's rule of law. That's a moral advance. We also see advance in truth from a kind of a mythical understanding of truth defined by Scripture to a scientific understanding of truth that's reached through objective experimentation and the scientific method. So these, the progress of beauty and truth, you know, this isn't just my value judgment. It's the value judgment of billions of people over thousands of years. Because if you look at the world, people have been moving generally from the traditional worldview to the modernist worldview, from the modernist worldview to what we call the postmodern worldview. Although there are some retrograde motions, in general, what people in the developing world want are the gifts of modernism. And those who've achieved modernism are interested in self-actualization in a new category. So, the values keep being redefined. We keep improving our definition of improvement itself. And that's one of the ways we evolve our culture.
When we talk about the evolution of beauty and truth, and it talks quite a bit about the transition from traditional values to modern values, what do you think is the addition that postmodern culture brings into that? And what do you think would and is that addition that a post-post modern culture would bring to the definition of these three values?
I'm sorry, can you rephrase or can you say that again?
You talked about the transition of values from traditional societies to modern societies,
mm-hmm.
but there's a specific set of the understanding of beauty and truth that comes with our postmodern society right now and our postmodern values. What do you think are these postmodern values or this postmodern understanding of beauty, truth, and goodness? And from there, where do you think does an evolutionary culture bring these two three values, beauty, truth, and goodness?
Sure. Yeah, great question. Well, again, cultural evolution especially occurs through both a push and a pull. The push is created by the problematic life conditions of a given societal context. And the pull is created by the ever-widening vision of a better way, right? The values of the vision of what is what improvement looks like, a better society. You know, that imagination of how it could be better serves to pull evolution forward. But that imagination itself is colored by what's currently wrong, right? And so it's sort of the new worldviews, new sets of values are forged between the push and the pull of evolutionary conditions. So the emergence of postmodernism occurred because of the pathologies of modernism beginning to build up, right? So, you know, modernism emerges with the Enlightenment, but by the 20th century, we see the horrors of World War through industrial technology. We see the degradation of the environment. We see nuclear proliferation and the threat of, you know, nuclear destruction. And these are all, significant pathologies which create a push for a new kind of culture, right? People get dissatisfied with modernism. Modernism's hubris. Modernism's inequality. Modernism's disregard for nature, disregard for those who've been marginalized or exploited in the process of modernists' development. So postmodernists begin to define a new worldview that transcends modernism by reference to the worst parts of modernism, right? And so this creates an opening for advance. So the postmodern values of beauty, truth, and goodness could be defined as the truth. It doesn't completely deny science, but it recognizes that scientific rationalism without any emotion and without any compassion has led to all kinds of problems, like, for example, nuclear proliferation. So a postmodern notion of truth is a more constructivist truth, a more subjective truth, a truth which involves reference to the community and not just to some objective scientific standard. And so truth becomes softened a little bit, right? Postmodern truth could be made fun of. You could say that for postmodernists, what's true is whatever's true for you. But obviously, you know, most don't take it to the extreme. They recognize the value of scientific, objective truth, but they also want to modify that with more subjective, more emotional, more community-based forms of truth. Likewise, when it comes to goodness, right? For modernism, goodness involves increasing status and material. The good life is defined as material abundance and achievement. And for postmodernists, the goodness becomes, in a sense, redefined. Instead of progress, they're interested in sustainability, right? Instead of the achievement of the individual, they're more interested in the integration of the community, right? Those who've been left behind, there's a new concern for them, right? Those who have not had the benefits of modernism, we want to bring them into the circle of compassion and take care of them. And so this leads to things like the civil rights movement, and it also leads to new definitions of, for example, alternative medicine and natural foods are forms of postmodern value that involve postmodern values of truth and goodness that begin to go beyond a purely materialistic or scientific understanding that dominates the modernist worldview. So I could go on about that, but let me turn to then...
Exactly.
Let me turn to this evolutionary...
Where do we go from here?
Right. So the part of... Just as postmodernism emerges through the opportunity created by the shortcomings or pathologies of modernism, this same technique is, in a sense, giving rise to the evolutionary worldview or the integral worldview that we are striving to participate in the emergence of now. And so we have to push off against the problems or the pathologies or the shortcomings of postmodernism, even while we're more aware than any previous worldview of our need to include postmodernism's evolutionary achievements, right? We're standing on the shoulders of postmodernism, and if we try to invalidate it or vilify it too much, then we're, in a sense, pulling the rug out from underneath our own advance. So one of the characteristics of these previous stages, traditional, modernist, and postmodern, which are sort of the major worldviews in the developing world, is that they each see each other primarily for their pathologies, right? So, you know, modernism sees traditionalism as sort of, duped by religion. And they see postmodernists, in a sense, as sort of weak and woo-woo and not rational. And likewise, postmodernists see modernists as sort of greedy, corporate, villainous enviro-rapers. I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration, but there's definitely contempt for modernism. And although they cherry-pick some of the values of traditionalism, in general, there's contempt for traditionalism and its ethnocentric morality. So these worldviews, we see a culture war, particularly here in the United States, between these major worldviews because when they view the worldview from outside of theirs, they see the problems primarily. And so what this means is that postmodernism emerges and it properly identifies, globe-threatening problems like environmental degradation and nuclear proliferation. But so far, postmodernism has been relatively politically impotent in its ability to solve these problems. It identifies these problems. It scolds the world for these problems. Proclaims impending doom for these problems, and indeed that's a real risk. But it doesn't have the power to influence modernism and the mainstream in a way that's going to achieve real political results around these problems. And so it's partially out of the dissatisfaction with the political and social impotency of postmodernism, because postmodernism is so countercultural and anti-modernist that it can't provide the leadership that is necessary on issues like progressive spirituality, environmentalism, multiculturalism. I mean, it's made some strides, but we want to see the laudable goals of postmodernism achieved more completely and more thoroughly, but in ways that don't squeeze the vitality out of modernism. So this evolutionary worldview is able to make its advance because it can recognize this dialectic of progress and pathology, the fact that every worldview, that its pathologies are tied directly to its enduring and necessary values. And so we can better recognize the difference between the enduring positive values and the associated pathologies, and therefore tease apart, right, the good from the bad, and include and use the values of all these previous worldviews in a more harmonious way that takes them all into account and recognizes that they're all part of a holonic structure, an internal cultural ecosystem, wherein we can't just vanquish modernism and go back to some localized, agrarian traditional style economy, especially with the world's population bubble. That would spell, the greatest disaster humanity's ever experienced. The way forward is to make modernism more sustainable, more friendly, more inclusive, globalization in a way that doesn't create gross inequalities and environmental degradation. Those are the goals of postmodernism, but as long as postmodernism remains in its stance of staunch anti-modernism, it's not going to have the ability to achieve those goals, and so this is one of the openings for improvement that's available to an integral perspective.
Steve, unfortunately, we come to the end of our time here, and I completely see that we only were able to touch some of the points you're making in your work and in your book, and hopefully some of our listeners will be able also to see you when you come to Europe, particular to the conference on the 13th of October in Paris at the Sorbonne, and you will be also the week before here in Frankfurt. And also, I just want to mention that your new book, Evolution's Purpose, hasn't come out yet, but it will come out in September. Is that right?
Yes, September 10th is the official publication date.
So we also can order it in these new times online via Amazon, and it's definitely a really comprehensive introduction into an evolutionary worldview. Steve, thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for this introduction into your thoughts and your work. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing you here in Europe soon.
Tom, thank you for your excellent questions and for this opportunity to speak with you. I very much look forward to doing our dialogue together in Frankfurt and to being with everyone there in Europe when I come in October.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.